The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
There are a lot of you here. I'm very scared. Okay. So I didn't actually know that I was going to have to sit here and, like, just talk about stuff. So who knows what I'm going to say. But basically, I'm here because in 2002, when I was 29, I had the bright idea of starting a blog about a four-year-old cookbook so that Nora Ephron would make a movie about it. That's not really how it worked. I'm here because I've been extraordinarily lucky. I did start a blog in 2002, having no clue what a blog even was. I thought it was so my mom could see what I was doing. And I did start a blog about a certain 40-year-old cookbook, The Extraordinary Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I have been just more lucky than you can possibly imagine ever since. I really, really stepped in the shit over and over again. So I want to talk just a little bit about how I got from there to here. It's been 7 years, which is actually, I have this great new career of oversharing professionally that I've had for 7 years now. And it's amazing. And it's been one amazing step after another, and so I'll talk a little bit about that, because people are interested about what it's like to have to be incredibly lucky. I was in 2002. I was a unhappy government employee, happily married, unhappily employed, and pretty convinced that I was never going to do anything with my life of any use at all. And I guess people could argue that I still haven't. But the project came out of that. Came out of just a sense of desperation. The mastering became a subject that I could continue to be compelled by. Blogging became the medium that kept me writing and developed my voice. Cooking became the thing that kept me sane when I was feeling extraordinarily lost. And out of all of that, I think I was lucky enough to stumble upon a subject that people are compelled by, because there are a lot of lost people in the world, whether they're 30-year-old secretaries or 60-year-old widowers or 13-year-old lacrosse players. I don't know. Everyone feels lost, and that just became, that's just a universal thing. And so I was lucky enough to tap into that, and that became a book deal, and that became a movie, and it's all really crazy. But the thing that's sort of strange, and then I'm going to start to talk about my new book, because a lot of you who, if any of you are here who read the book and loved the book, or saw the movie and loved the movie, are going to really hate me, because this book is a turn, and I'm trying to explain a bit about how I got from Julie and Julia to Amy Adams' Julie and Julia to this, because the thing that's strange about my situation is that I really was just purely lucky. And people look at me and they say, well, you won the lottery. And I did. In August 2002, I signed up for a blog space on salon.com, and I put in my number and I hit it big. And it was a lottery win. And I am thankful every day for it. But the thing about, you have this perception that when you win the lottery, then everything is awesome after that. And it's not quite that simple. I'm I never want to stop saying how grateful I am for everything that's happened in the last few years, but life didn't suddenly get simple. Life presented a whole new set of problems and issues, and that's what this new book, Cleaving, is about. It's also about butchering. It's also about cutting up animals, so that's the fun part. The basic easy way to describe Cleaving, a story of marriage, meat, and obsession, is, this is the radio-friendly part of it, is that it's about a six-month stint that I spent at a wonderful butcher shop in Kingston, New York, called Fleischer's. If you ever in the area, you should go, because it's extraordinary. And I butchered there. I apprenticed as a butcher there for six months. And so that's kind of what the book covers. But the book also covers why I decided that I needed to apprentice as a butcher, which is not, it's obvious to me, but to other people it's not, so it seems a little confusing. Why butchery? And why now? And the answer to that is twofold. The first part of the answer is that butchering is butchers are somewhat people I've been fascinated by since I moved to New York. I moved to New York in 1995, and I grew up in Austin, Texas, in suburban, sort of a nice suburban part of Austin, and all of my meat came from supermarkets and was wrapped up in cellophane, and I didn't know that those old school butcher shops really existed anymore, and so I moved to New York. And I find them, and it's like I'd walked into, a set of The Godfather or something, and I became very fascinated with the sights, with the smells. I mean, the smell of dry aging meat and these beautiful roasts and ducks and hams but most of all, these guys. And I find, is that funny? I find butchers really sexy, and Because they're so sure of themselves, and they've been doing this work for decades upon decades, and they know exactly what they're doing, and it's almost the knives have become part of themselves, and they know how the meat comes together and comes apart, and what you're supposed to do with it. And I can ask them how to cook a crown roast, and they know. I can ask them what to do with beef heart, and they know. And that just, I've never, I was a person, especially at this particular time in my life when I was going through a pretty serious crisis with my husband, Eric, and our marriage, and I was sure of nothing. There was nothing that I was sure of. I didn't know if I wanted to be married. I didn't know what I wanted, if I could be a writer. I didn't know anything, and these guys knew something absolutely, and that sureness to me was exotic and reassuring and sexy, and I was very envious of that. So that's one reason, butchery. The other reason is that I'm kind of a project girl. The Julie Julia Project, obviously, was one of those instances. I have one story I always think of when I think about sort of trying to describe this sort of mania that I have. When Eric proposed to me when I was 24 years old, we'd been together since we were 18, and he proposed to me, and then the next morning he got on a plane to Kazakhstan for 6 months. So I was planning a wedding by myself, or with my mom, and I was 24. So I was very, very attracted to the whole big white princess dress and the 250 guests and the bridesmaids and the flowers. So I was planning this big wedding, and about 3 weeks before the wedding, I decided that all of my guests, all 250 of them, had to have little sculptures of naked ladies that I would make. So I spent the last 3 weeks before I got married making little teeny tiny naked lady sculptures. And so that's what I do. This is what I do. And so, when this, years later, a decade later almost, Eric and I found ourselves adrift And after Julie and Julia, the book, and the book was coming out, my life had changed profoundly. I was a writer. I was successful. I was doing what I wanted to do for a living, and my marriage was falling apart. And I was in love with another man. He was seeing someone else, too. It was, nothing made sense. And so I was, project. And the butcher shop became a haven for me while I was working this out, which I know sounds really weird to people, but was definitely how I felt. So that's sort of what it's about. I'm going to tell one little story, and then Sam's, I'm like totally disjointed here. I apologize. I'm going to tell a story, and then I'm going to read, and then I'm going to ask questions because I'm really, really good at answering questions. It's like my best thing ever. So everyone's understandably really excited about, there's a movie. It was made about you. You're played by Amy Adams. Amy Adams is so cute. It's also awesome. And that's all true. It is awesome. And then I get, so are they going to make Cleaving into a movie? And, you know, of course, the real answer is yes. Nora Ephron is knocking down my door to make this movie about meat and S&M. Yeah, great. No, she's not, actually. But my story about the good part of my life, and this is something that makes me very happy, probably the best thing so far to come out of the second book, and this is going to mean something to a group this big, maybe six of you, maybe? And I encourage you to raise your hands if this excites you at all. Most of you, just indulge me. I sent this book when it came out in galleys. I was asked to send this book to people that you really admire. If you had your dream of who could blurb the book, who would it be? So I thought of some people. And one of the people I sent it to was Joss Whedon, for whom I'm a huge fan of. He's those 296 of you who don't know who he is. He did Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Yes, exactly. I'm a huge fan. Just total fangirl. I'm completely ridiculous on the subject. And so I sent him a copy of the book saying, if you would like to blurb this, it would be great. And I don't hear from him for months. I didn't expect to. And then I get a call from Nora Ephron's assistant. And this is another way that my life is weird, is that I get calls occasionally from Nora Ephron's assistant. Not very often, but every once in a while. And he said, I just gave your email to Joss Whedon. Is that okay? Yes. And he'd read the book, and he was a fan. And we had dinner. Which is really, like, literally the sexiest moment of my life. And so we were talking about who's going to make the movie of Cleaving. And he thinks David Cronenberg, which I think would be pretty good. A little Viggo Mortensen butchery action in there somewhere. So that's where you got to kind of put your brain when you're thinking about Cleaving. It's way more a Cronenberg thing than a Nora Ephron thing. And people get upset about that because it is different. And because, people love Eric Powell a lot, and with good reason. And so I'm sort of the villain of the piece in this because I do terrible things to Eric Powell. But it all comes out okay in the end, and so I just want to prepare any of you who are like really invested in Julie and Julia and that marriage, and especially if you're invested in Amy Adams and Julie and Julia. Like, picturing her in this movie, I mean, in this book is hilarious, but ultimately, it's gonna screw you up. I would suggest picking a new actress to think about, because it's going to get a little nutty. So, since I'm obviously really bad at just talking off the cuff, I'm going to read a little bit to give you a bit of a sense of what the book's about. I'm going to read one section, and then if we get really bored, we'll go into the Q&A, and if not, then I'll read a little bit more. But this section is just pretty much straight butchery. This is from my first day working at the shop. You're going to hear some names. You're going to hear Josh. You're going to hear Jessica. You're going to hear Tom. Josh and Jessica run Fleischer's. They're amazing, amazing people. You should go to Kingston and say I sent you and buy their meat because they're very cool. But here we go. Excuse me. God, what was that? The meat hook is a C-shaped curve of steel, about the size of my curled thumb and forefinger, with a viciously sharp point on one end and an orange plastic grip on the other. I hold it as if it were a bicycle handle, the base of the hook emerging from between my index and middle fingers. With it, I can get a sure grasp on the bone and a means to turn gravity to my advantage. It's funny about meat hooks. I've had the phrase meat hooks in my vocabulary for as long as I can remember, accompanied by the vision of a broad-chested, letter-jacketed thug pawing at a comely bobby-soxer. And I never gave the origin of the word any thought. I think I was picturing fleshy, too big mitt hands. Actually, using this meat hook, a sharp, small, thin tool that fits so coolly and easily in the palm, provokes a tiny, almost imperceptible shift of perspective. Meat hooks aren't like meat hooks at all. They're much more effective and terrifying. I find myself wondering idly if the first 50s co-ed to utter the phrase, "Get your meat hooks off me," was a butcher's daughter. As I pull down on the orange handle now, the bone gets looser. I help it along, scraping, sawing through the sinews, marrying it to the rounded edge of the thigh bone. As more of the bone loosens, the rest of it comes easily away, until by the end, I'm hardly using the knife, just yanking down and toward me with the hook. "We keep the bones?" "Keep the bones! Keep the bones!" Tom bellows. In addition to working and instructing here at Fleischer's, Tom teaches butchery at the Culinary Institute of America in nearby Hyde Park, and has therefore developed his comically stentorian delivery. "Shut the fuck up!" Josh bellows right back. Not sure where Josh developed his stentorian delivery, but he sure as hell has. "Josh, would you stop yelling?" This from Jessica, Josh's tiny wife, ensconced in her office, working over invoices. "The store is fucking open!" I like this place. After the H-bone is out, it really is pretty simple. There are two connected bones remaining in the hunk of meat, each of them shaped like a Flintstone sort of thing, what pebbles would have stuck through her hair. Bigger, of course. I stab down through the meat at the top edge, where the evident shiny white end of one of these bones sticks out, and I slice down along its top to the next joint until I've exposed its entire length. Then I get in there, the fingers of my right hand sunk deep in the meat crevice I've just made, peering inside, while with my left hand, my cutting hand, I scrape down along both sides of the bone and down under. The meat is cold from its time in the cooler. Every once in a while, I take my hands out and shake them around, blow into my cupped palms. "Careful there," says Tom. "Get numb. You could lose a finger without feeling it. And we have a hell of a time moving finger sausage." Tom thinks he's pretty funny. I gradually reveal the bones, peel them out, and all that's left is a messy mound of pig flesh, probably 15 pounds of it. This I just carelessly cut into large chunks with my scimitar, rolling my eyes a little inwardly when Tom hands me the hugely impressive knife, one of his own personal collection, and tells me what it's called. Between the scimitars and the scabbards and the chainmail gloves, it sometimes seems like the butchery industry was created by a bunch of testosterone-poisoned D&D nerds. More meat for sausage. "All done. Good. There's the next one for you." So I attack the second one. It's gratifying how much more quickly it goes than the first did. I do love me a steep learning curve. Tom is finished up and heading out, off to teach his evening class. So now I'm alone at the table, mostly, except when Aaron passes on his way from the front counter, which he's working today, to the kitchen, where he's monitoring roast beef in the oven, slowly bubbling beef stock on the stove. "How's it coming, Jules?" he calls out with extravagant good cheer. "Can I call you Jules?" I answer to pretty much anything. He throws some arched eyebrows my way. "Anything, huh? I'll have to think on that." Aaron is a CIA grad. CIA culinary school, not exploding cigars and covert arms deal CIA. And about my age, with close-cropped dark hair, startling blue eyes, and almost palpable enthusiasms. I barely know him, but I have known a few CIA grads in my time, and he has the vibe. Boyishly eager, impressed with himself, sort of like a Harvard grad without all the money. I like him, but he's a little intimidating. I try not to let him see it. I throw some eyebrow action right back at him. You do that. I don't even know what we're talking about. It's just random innuendo, locker talk without a subject matter. I'm almost through with my pork round when Josh strides up from the back with a whole side of pork, 80 pounds of pig, slung casually over his shoulder. Without a word, he rolls the thing onto the table. He takes his knife from the metal scabbard chained around his waist with a pink bicycle lock. Yo, Uncle Sweet Tits, he calls to Aaron, who's in the kitchen stirring around some chicken bones roasting in the oven. I'm going to kick your ass now. Jesse, the tall, thin, beaky kid who works the front of the shop, he's quiet, a reader of Harper's and Wired, who is teased mercilessly for drinking green tea, leans up against the case to watch. He evidently knows what's coming. Josh points with his knife to the clock on the wall, like Babe Ruth pointing his bat at the center field bleachers at Wrigley Field, and sets to work. Pulls off the kidney and kidney fat with a single yank, gets in and quickly carves out the tenderloin nestled in under the spine, tosses it to the table. With thick but quick fingers, he counts 5 ribs down from the shoulder, works his knife tip intricately between those 2 vertebrae, then, once they're separated, slices the shoulder away from the loin with 1 sweeping pistol grips cut straight down to the table. Picks up the butcher saw, like a hacksaw writ large, and with 3 swipes, cuts across the ribs a couple of inches down, out from the triangular column of meat that runs along the rib cage's outer curve against the backbone. Once he's through the bone, he puts down the saw, picks up his knife, and runs it along the saw cut he's just made, down to the table, curving up closer to the spine as he gets past the ribs, toward the hip joint, separating the belly from the loin. Then pulls the carcass to the edge of the table so that the rear leg is hanging off, leans hard with 1 thick forearm on the loin that rests on the table, while pushing suddenly, heavily, onto the hoof with his other arm, really putting some serious pressure into it. A mighty crack, and the hip joint is opened up. 1 more raking slice through to wood, and the round is off the loin, swinging floorward, held tight in Josh's big muff of a hand. He slams the ham to the table with a meaty smack, staring at the clock. Hey, pussy, he yells. 1:25. We have customers, goddammit, Jessica calls, not really expecting to be heated. Aaron sticks his head out from the kitchen. Fuck you, really? Boop. Making an eloquent upward gesture, low down, middle finger extended. Right up your rectum. Aaron shakes his head as a timer alarm goes off from somewhere over the stove. Okay, man, I'm coming for you. He jabs the greasy end of a meat thermometer in Josh's direction. I'm coming. Don't mess with chocolate thunder. Aaron and Josh, co-chairs of the nickname committee, seem to disagree on Aaron's moniker. Jessica walks by on her way to the back of the shop in her padded orange vest and jeans, her frizzy hair twisted up on top of her head. She rolls her eyes in my direction as she passes, muttering, Jesus Christ, with equal parts exasperation and affection. I really like this place. I go back into the remains of my pork round and immediately send the tip of my knife skittering across the meaty flesh of my thumb. It gets way worse than that. It doesn't so much hurt as startle me. I yank my hand out of the meat with a little whispered, shit. Josh turns to me with mild eyes. You lose a finger, genius? It's a tiny thing. Blood, though, welling up through the smooth, translucent smile of the sideways slice. It's nothing. Jessica calling from the back. Oh, yes, please, let's have the unpaid, uninsured apprentice cut off a digit on her first day. It's nothing. Let me see. He roughly grabs my hand, peers at it. Dude, that's nothing. That's what I said. Come on. He leads me to the back of the kitchen, where there's a shoebox full of first aid supplies on a shelf over the big metal restaurant sink. Rinse that out real good, he says, as he rummages through the box. When I finished washing and drying my hand, blood is still running in more than expected amounts, he dabs me with a drop from a dark green vial. Oregano oil, it says. What kind of crap, hippie crap is that? It is a testament to Josh's ability to put people at ease that a good girl like me is flipping shit to the boss before the first day is out. Beats Neosporin all to shit. He wraps a Band-Aid around the cut. You put a glove on that. Don't want you bleeding all over my meat. So, that's that. What time is it?
time is it?
You don't have to clap. So that kind of gives you a taste of what the butchering was like. And I think that probably the section I was going to read you about why the hell I was doing it is probably a little long. But I'm going to pick you out a little bit. Because the thing about butchering is that I came to it with all the stereotypes that person comes to butchering thinking, you know, that it's about brute force, it's about hacking, it's about destroying. But in fact, it's a very delicate art. 80% of, or 90% of butchering you can do with the 1-inch tip end of a 5-inch boning knife, or with your fingers. And there's something in butchering called, the butchers call these things seams, which is the connective tissue between two muscles that adjoin one another, and they become a kind of roadmap, so that if you have a giant, you know, 150-pound chuck shoulder, you can follow the seams between the muscles and break down that shoulder into its parts with very little force. They come apart as if they were meant to come apart in that way. And there's something really moving about that to me, and really beautiful. And the action of it is very meditative. And the advantage to that, and I didn't realize when I was getting to butchery that was what it was going to be like, is that it gave me, in a time when my brain was spinning, running around like a hamster on a wheel, it gave me the space to and the focus to sort of let that hamster rest and let that hamster philosophize. I guess hamsters philosophize, but maybe they do. And sit with what was going on. And so I'm just going to read a quick little bit that's sort of the kind of thing I was thinking when I was at the table and the kind of stuff I was working through. I'm going to skip a little bit. Short ribs are perhaps my very favorite thing to eat, maybe along with oxtail. Now, there's favorite and favorite, of course, an exquisitely aged strip steak of the kind Josh and Jess sell at Fleischer's, from a beast raised on grass and just a bit of good grain, living a life as pleasant as a steer's life can be, aged for 3 weeks until the flesh is buttery and the meaty flavor is concentrated to an almost unbearable degree, is a rare pleasure. At $25 a pound, it ought to be rare anyway. Sexy and indulgent, and rather like being in bed with a man who does things just right without being asked. But short ribs contain a different kind of intimacy, a clandestine close to the boneness, and so much fun because they're sort of a secret. And oxtails are even more of a secret than that. It's the name that camouflages them so well. Oxtail. That is just 5 kinds of unpleasant. And it also happens to be exactly accurate. Oxtails come out of the box that each steer is delivered with, containing all the extra bits Josh might want to use. There's the liver and the heart, which is also delicious, and not scary at all once you've gotten yourself around all the metaphors and imagery. A heart is just a muscle, after all, which is something I should remember more often. The tongue, the sweetbreads, occasionally, if we're lucky. Sweetbreads, another instance of necessary euphemism, are actually thymus glands and are a pain in the ass to remove. Generally not worth it unless you're working with a large number of slaughtered animals at a time. And the tail, which looks just like a tail. A little more than a foot long, 2 or 3 inches in diameter at the base, tapering to a point, threaded through with the last bones of the vertebrae, getting smaller all the time. To prepare the oxtails for the case, ready to cook and eat, you cut between each vertebra, which is a fun thing to do because it's so much easier than you'd think. At this point, each is joined to the next by cartilage that is simple to cut through with a boning knife once you find the right spot. And although the bones are getting narrower and narrower in diameter, they're all the same length, so once you've found the first point of breach, it's child's play to guess where the next will come. It makes me feel powerful and smart and, yes, a little sexy to cut up oxtails. When I'm done, I'm left with about 10 cylinders of meat and bone, all the same height, the thickest of them lush rosettes of meat with bright white centers, the smallest ones no larger than a fingertip, almost entirely white, hardly any meat to them at all. Arranged on a plate for the case, they seem to naturally fit together into a whirling floral circle, the most beautiful thing on display. And yet no one buys them. They are my secret. I take them home and cook them for myself. And for Eric, of course. I've spent a lot of time thinking about D. Sorry, D is the other fella. You can figure out for yourself what D stands for. I have some suggestions. I spent a lot of time thinking about D, about the desolation I feel without him. I wake up with him in my head, go to sleep with him still there, drink and drink to try to make him go away. Even the butchery, that blessed distraction, that way I can take a knife and do something new, break something apart to make something else beautiful, understand something, a body, its parts, the logic of it. Even that chases the memory of my old lover, the longing for him, to the far edges of my mind, but not away. He's always there when I quit for the day, wash up, drive back to the city or to my small rental apartment, retreating into the dark with my iPod for company, all the songs reminding me of him. Is like watching a fire dying in the wilderness at night, the creeping thing getting closer, hovering at the edge of the light. I've thought a lot about that. And yet sometimes I think I've thought almost not at all about my marriage of 10 years, about the man I've known and loved since I was 18 years old, a child, unformed, about the man who formed me, not like a sculptor, not like a person of intention and power, but like a sapling taking root too closely to its sister, so that they grew and slowly grew, until so many years later, you'd think they were one tree, their branches so entwined, their bark overlapping, their trunks joined. Now that they are essentially one thing, to kill one would be to kill them both. I haven't let myself think much about that. Eric would say, does say, that the reason for this is that I have no room in my besotted, childish mind for him anymore, that D has overtaken me, seduced me, made me small, and that my love for him, my yearning, is all I feel anymore. There's some truth to this version. But there's also a gigantic hole in it. D does consume me, still. When one has eaten a beautiful dry-aged steak, one remembers it, longs for it. That longing doesn't stop. At least, it hasn't yet, and doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. But that's not the reason I've not been writing about Eric. The thing is this. Longing, love, lust, all those L words, that's easy to write about. I can think about the way D made love to me, or the way his hair felt silky under my fingers, or that mole on the inside of his index finger, or that tiny lump in his earlobe, and I'm there. I'm living it again. I'm remembering something I had and don't have anymore, something I don't have to imagine doing without because I'm doing without it. I may cry afterward from the loss, but there's pleasure in it as well. But to think about Eric now, after these years of pain, is to contemplate something incomprehensible to me, separation. Of course, I've thought about it. We both have. We've even done it. But because I've spoken the words, because I've lived without him for a period of time, doesn't mean I understand it. Eric's right. I don't think about our marriage that much, not in the way I think about being in bed with D. But it's for the same reason I don't ponder my veins or the floor of my room. I don't ponder because I don't even see the world without it. It's too big or buried too deep, with edges that thin out to nothingness, binding itself to everything else. It's embedded in my dark, precious flesh. I'm going to stop there. Hush. So I have very little concept of time, but I think maybe we're Q&A-ing now. All right. And I have someone here who's going to like...
We've got a couple of people who'd like
something. Andy's going to take charge here.
Hi. I think most of you know how this works. If you get your hand up, we'll get a mic to you, and you can ask a question. And please wait for the microphone. Who would like to start us off?
Anybody?
Bashful? Nope, right on the aisle there.
Hi. In listening to the first part of the book, mm-hmm. I'd like to know what you think of these evangelical, vegan, vegetarian nutcases.
What do you think about them?
That obviously...
I feel like there's an opinion coming off of you.
Well, obviously they have problems, I think, with self-image and how they can live on a level sleep. I think they obviously have problems with their sensuality and sexuality as well, because they don't think that food is pleasure like we do. And I'd like to know what you think, because I think they have serious problems.
I think you answered the question. No, it's funny. I have to tell you, yes. I mean, I have very little patience with... I mean, I think that vegetarians and vegans are largely sanctimonious pricks. But I will say that I am I am more sympathetic to where they're coming from, actually, after working at the butcher shop than I was. Not because anything that I saw at the butcher shop that disturbed me at all. Not at all. I'm very proud of the work that they do at Fleischer's and the meat that comes out of there, and it's very, they're Josh and Jessica are kind of meat missionaries, and all their meat is very, it's local, and it's, you know, hormone-free and pasture-raised and ethically slaughtered and all of that. But I am more aware of wanting to know where my meat comes from, and so I understand way more than I did that sort of obsession with really knowing the provenance of your food. Josh was a vegan for 17 years, including 6 months after he started the butcher shop. So they're kind of like these weird vegan butchers. It's very strange. And so I do have more sympathy than I used to. The person that's coming to my mind, who comes to my mind right now all the time, actually I have this very strange relationship with this man. I've never met him, but Jonathan Safran Foer. His book, Eating Animals, just came out. And he and I have the same publicist, and it just so happens that he and I are both like these really needy, neurotic people. So my poor publicist is like fielding calls from both of us all the time, and we're like the bizarro world version of each other. And I've never met. I've read the book. I think he's a sanctimonious prick, but he's not wrong. He isn't. I do think that food is not important to him in the same way it's important to me. The taste of it, the experience of it, the sensuality of it is something that he's able to do without. But I respect, even though, you know, I spent reading that book, with my eyes like permanently rolled up in the back of my head. I respect the journey that he was trying to make and trying to figure out what he can eat and what he can't. We're both anti-industrial farming. We're both trying, really concerned with trying to start the huge project of changing the way Americans eat meat and eat in general. And I think the main difference between him and me is I could watch, a pig that I could see was healthy and happy be slaughtered humanely and cut off a pork chop and eat it. And he couldn't do that. Also, I could totally take him in a cage match. But I actually have more patience than I used to. But they'll drive you crazy. There's no question.
Anybody want to defend the position? Jonathan. Who's next? Right in the corner here.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
When life gives you lemons, make lemonade, you're one of my heroines, I must admit. Now, you were doing the blog.
Mm-hmm.
And how long before things, seem to be taking on a life of its own in the history of that?
Well, it was, it happened in sort of in stages. It wasn't that long before I realized I had a readership. I mean, that was the first thing. It's like, oh my God, someone other than my mother is reading this. So that was the first nice big step. And that probably took, it took me, I would say by 3 months in, I had a pretty solid blog readership. Again, have to point out, this was in 2002. This was, the blogosphere was a much smaller place, and I was very lucky to have come in when I did, and it was easier to get acknowledged. And by probably 6 or 7 months in, I was beginning to get sort of traditional media attention, art, and there's a scene in the movie that. But the Christian Science Monitor was going to come and interview me, and in fact, he in the movie they had him not come because Judith Jones couldn't come, but he actually did come, and I had an article, and that once that traditional media started going, by 7 or 8 months into the project, I could tell something was happening. I didn't really know what it was. I was too insanely crazed trying to cook all this crap that I couldn't really think about it. And I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to jinx it. I didn't want to, you know, I'm just going to, I was very determined, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to write about it as best I can, get through it, and then we'll see what happens. And then when the article came out in the New York Times, which was about 2 weeks before the end of the year, end of the project, that was when things kind of went through crazy through the roof. And after that, it just kind of all fell into place very, very quickly. So, yeah.
And we'll stay right here, third row.
How did you meet the Fleischers, and how did you talk your way into this apprenticeship?
I spoke to a lot of butchers in the city, in Manhattan, and you know, various places. And your average old school butcher is not going to let some clueless chick behind their counter with sharp knives. It's just stupid. I had a friend who, she's a playwright, and she goes up to Woodstock on this artist residency every summer, so she's familiar with the area. And there was an article in the New York Times, dining section, that was about local farming and local meat raising, and Jessica, I think, was quoted in it, you know, being from Fleischer's. And so she said, did you see this? You should go and talk to them. I walked in there, and actually I sent them an email. I was very formal. My name is Julie Powell, and I would really like to apprentice. And didn't hear back or anything. And I went up there, and I walked in the door, and you know, Josh was there. I mean, I didn't know it was Josh at the time. He's this like pretty big guy with long red hair and tattoos everywhere and big handlebar mustache. And I was like, hi, I want to butcher. And he was like, all right. And he had no idea who I was. He had no idea anything. He's just crazy like that. It's actually, I came into the shop at this really amazing period when they were, it was sort of like the Wild West era, you know, it was still the frontier in this butcher shop, and nobody really knew what they were doing. The store was pretty new, and they were experimenting with all kinds of crazy stuff. Nowadays, he charges $10,000 for a six-week butchery course. I got it free for 6 months. So, I just walked in, and they let me in, and it was such an extraordinary experience. And now, of course, butchering is just like, it's the hip new thing. Butchers are like rock stars now. And I just figured out butchery was awesome like 2 years before everybody else did. So I got very lucky on that.
Let's keep going here in the fourth row.
Hello, my name is Julie too, actually.
Hi, Julie.
I find your point about being lost and finding yourself through this project or whatnot. I think, like you said, it's very universal. And I was just wondering, what would you recommend to people that also have this inspiration to just express themselves through writing but haven't been formally trained but just want to do something with it but don't really know where to start, and mm-hmm. how it works? Like, how do you do something with
that? Well, I mean, I fell into it, certainly. I mean, I'd always wanted to be a writer, so it's not like I was like, oh, goodness, here, I'm going to write. It was something I wanted to do for a long time. But my struggle for years and years and years was, well, A, if you're a writer, the first step is the doozy. It's convincing yourself that it's worth your, that you're worth your time. And it's hideously hard. And I'd spent years and years and years not knowing. And for me, what happened was that the blogging medium, as it was understood in 2002, which was not at all, and the subject matter, Mastering, which was this book that I just found extraordinarily compelling, came together to be something that I wasn't having to force myself to write anything. I wasn't having to convince myself that, because I spent all these years, I had the half a novel in a desk like everybody else, and every time I looked at it, I wanted to shoot myself because. But there was something about the drive of the book, the inspiration of the book and the drive of the medium that kept me from that, turned off that switch, turned off that self-editing you know, you're an asshole, don't stop doing this, switch. And that's that, you have to get that off. You have to turn that off. And for me, I think it's about, I don't know. I mean, blogging was such a different thing then. It was so organic. It was so intuitive. It really wound up affecting my voice as a writer because it was so intimate and because I didn't realize what I was doing. And if I blogged now, it wouldn't be the same because everyone recognizes what blogging is now. But I really think it's about finding a subject that is so overwhelmingly compelling that it shuts off the part of you that's saying, you can't do this, this is not worth it. That's really what it is. And it takes some time to figure it out. But once you figure it out, you're going to know. And if people say you're crazy and you're stupid, that's probably a good sign. I'm always one for following the very bad ideas, which, you know, it's not always neat. This book is a testament to how unneat that can be. But it gets you places you wouldn't go otherwise.
No. Okay, about 8 rows back here.
Hi, my name's Sarah, and I was wondering about your future projects. Like, mm-hmm. You've always done these specific, like, things that you focused on. Mm-hmm. So in future projects, like, are you going to be still associated with cooking? Or some sort of culinary topic?
Who knows?
Or is it too soon to know?
I'm trying to get. Well, my main goal is to not write another memoir next. I need to sort of get out of that. Two memoirs before the age of 40 is plenty. But you know, I mean, I think on the one hand, I do think I'm always going to be a person that is attracted to projects and challenges and things like that. So that's probably going to come up again and again. But right now, the challenge that I'm setting myself right now is to move into fiction. My undergraduate degree was in fiction writing, and that's always what I thought I wanted to be. So that's that. My next project is going to be a novel, which terrifies the living hell out of me, which I think again is probably a good sign. That's my next. But you know what? And the thing about my projects is that they sort of pop into my head, and then I start doing them. There's no planning involved ever. So you know, I could wake up tomorrow and decide I need to start, you know, getting into dog racing or something. It could happen.
Back here and on our left, about 8 rows on your left.
Hi. I was wondering, while I'm sure it's wonderful that, you know, when you got the call that your book was being turned into a movie, if what was the hardest part about that process for you? Was there something on screen that was really difficult for you not to have control over, or something that bothered you about the...
You know, no. I didn't have much trouble kind of giving up my baby in that sense. You know, I passed the book on to Nora. It was very clear it was going to become a Nora Ephron movie. And obviously, how can you not be fine with your first book being made into a movie with Meryl Streep? But, so, damn it! I was really pretty okay with it. The things that bother me are just so stupid. There are three things that irritate me about the movie. I am irritated that she stopped in front of a Scharfenberger chocolate fountain and went, ooh, I want to make a chocolate cream pie. I hate that. And though it was interesting that I think a chocolate fountain, it was so like 2002. It was sort of a period piece. Who does chocolate fountains anymore? So that was kind of cool, but I, no. Second, I wouldn't, she there's a scene where she goes into Dean and DeLuca and buys like $40 olive oil and crap like that. And I had three separate mentions of Dean and DeLuca in my book about, because I hate it. I hate Dean and DeLuca. I hate it. So that was really annoying.
Why do you hate it?
Because it's like the epitome of food snob, foodie, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there are things in it I love, but you go there and people are buying their croissants there for lunch, and I hate them. I hate everyone in there. And No, there are four things. There are four things that I hate about the movie. The third thing is the scene with the friends. You know, the bitchy friends who are all... Yeah, I know, people love it. People love it. And it's in the trailer. And it's, but it's so not me. It's so, you know, people ask me about that all the time. And they're, oh, your friends were like that. I was like, that is so a Nora invention. I mean, and it's very, very Nora Ephron. It's like, I like my friends, actually. And I just thought that was a very weird... I mean, I know why they did it. I absolutely know why. You know, they had to set up the character and, you know, bitchy friends was a sort of shorthand for, you know, misery in New York. But so this irritated me a little. And then the last one is, and this is completely understandable, I totally get it, it's a PG-13 movie, you get one fuck, Stanley Tucci got it, and it was a really good one. I don't begrudge him that. But I really wish they hadn't had my character say, is it because I use the F word every once in a while? The F word? Like, who says that? Completely nuts. And that is the one moment in the movie every time I watch it, I'm like, want to tear my face off. But it's a lovely movie. I really do think it's wonderful. And, you know, Amy is extraordinarily sweet and nothing like me. And... But lovely, and of course Meryl Streep and Christmas. I'm actually a huge crush on Chris Messina. The other day I had a dream about my husband, about Eric, but Chris Messina played him. It's true.
Let's keep going here. We've got time for a few more.
Hi. I really love you. I just think you're so funny.
Thanks.
And you're just like sunshine. I'm from Texas, too.
I could tell.
Yeah. I'm a food blogger myself, and I concentrate on the connection between food and love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, over your past 7 years, what sort of ideas you have between food and love and this long journey that you've had? Mm-hmm. And I have a second question. In Cleaving, you seem so very honest about your life, and I think you say that it's oversharing, but it's just so honest that I'm wondering if that was hard for you to write that way and not sugarcoat anything and really put yourself out there, which I applaud you for.
Thank you. So I'll answer that part first, because that's the tough one. Yes, it was hard, but it was also necessary. In some ways it came easier than Julie and Julia, because I just needed to write it. I was, you know, I started writing Cleaving. I was still pretty much reeling from the events that had occurred, that were covered in here. And, you know, I was confused. I didn't understand what any of it meant. I was very uncertain about where I was with Eric and where I was with Dee, and all of it was just, it was killing me. It was really still killing me. And the book became, I think that people who use their lives as creative fodder do it because the writing is absolutely necessary to the process of understanding what it means and what comes out of it. So the writing of the book was essential to me. So it was hard, and living with it was hard, and reliving it now while I'm touring and reading it is hard, but it was so necessary that it wasn't even ever a question of can I do this, can I not. I had to. Food and love. Gosh. You know, I think it's always food has been, preparing food for the people I love has always been, it's the primary thing I do for the people I love. Food, eating and books. Books and eating. You know, I think one of the warning signs with Dee should have been that he had no interest in eating my food. And I mean, he pretended, he was okay with it. He also didn't like dogs, so it was really like beep beep beep. You know, I think if you can't trust the person you're with in the kitchen, if you can't be with them there, if you can't experience, you know. I remember actually there was a moment with Dee where he asked me to teach him how to cook. He doesn't know how to cook at all, and I was teaching him how to cook a pork chop, and you know, I had the skillet on high, and I was going to, very simple, I was going to brown it on both sides, stick it in the oven, and you know, some, there was some oil in the pan, and I put the pork chop in, and it, you know, spattered. And he was like horrified. I was like, you know what? If you can't get that this is happens, and you're going to get oil, you know, you're going to get burns, and you're going to get cut, and things are going to make noise and you know, smell extreme, and that's, you don't have any place here. Go away. So that's sort of my connection, is that you have to, cooking requires a kind of trust that is also required for loving someone, so.
Another question in back there.
Hi there, thanks for coming to Philly, and congrats on your success.
Where are you? I can't see you.
Oh, sorry, here.
Sorry.
I had two questions. With all the success you had with the release of your first book being made into a movie with, you know, one of the greatest actresses of all time, did you find that when you're writing your second book, mm-hmm. that you felt at some level you were writing a screenplay? And then the second follow-up is, if this doesn't get made into a movie, and I'm sure you get this, will you feel at some level even let down a bit?
No, actually, no one's ever quite asked me that exact question before. I was not thinking that I was writing a screenplay when I was writing Cleaving. No, I wasn't. because you know, I was writing Cleaving before the movie came out. I was writing it, you know, right after I finished writing Julie and Juliet. So it was, you know, that was sort of definitely not in my mind. Of course, by the time the book is coming out and there's all this expectation surrounding the you know, Julie and Juliet, the movie, it becomes an inevitable question. So who's going to make the... And it was certainly not something I was thinking at the time, but it's also certainly something that I've been, you know, asked about and that I think about occasionally now that the movie has come out. And... I don't know. I won't be disappointed if... I mean, come on. I won't be disappointed if my second book doesn't get made into a movie with Meryl Streep, though that would be awesome. But thinking about this being made into a movie is sort of terrifying and fascinating at the same time, because it's so much more personal. I mean, when I watch Amy Adams play this version of me, it's very easy to say, well, that's not really me, and what is she doing really except cooking lots of recipes? There's nothing, you know, horrifying about that. You know, watching Amy Adams, you know, you know, cutting up meat and getting tied up, and you know, that could get a little horrifying. So it scares me, it could be really, really interesting too. So I won't be let down, but it certainly would be a crazy, crazy, awesome ride if it happened. Mostly awesome, also horrifying, but pretty amazing.
We'll finish up right down here in front.
In your butchering experience here, did you have any contact with the animal when it was alive? With the slaughtering of the animal, with the way they're raised?
Mm-hmm. I didn't actually, with my own hands, slaughter an animal. I witnessed several slaughters. I witnessed... the CIA does a pig slaughter every fall that with a local farmer. And so I went there and, you know, met the farmer, met the pigs. You know, they were, you know, beautiful animals. And you know, and it's a little disconcerting. You're watching these, and they're not industrially farmed pigs. They're out in a field, and they're rolling in the mud like they like to do, and they're chasing each other around, and they're coming up to get their heads pet, and it's adorable. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, they're pork chops. And that's, for me, that was, you know, it's not that it's not disconcerting. It is. But watching that process and seeing how it happened and seeing that it was very quick and it was very, you know, humanely done, made me feel better about the meat that I was eating. So, and you know, knowing that that's how that happened. I was also when I was in Tanzania, I traveled quite a bit. One of the places I went was Tanzania, and I spent some time with a guy named Kesema, who's Maasai, and he has a nonprofit organization for Maasai women called Kitsumute that's to help them literacy and education so that they can be more independent than they are. Most Maasai women don't speak Swahili, so they're pretty isolated. And don't have any kind of monetary power. So he's, anyway, it's another story. But I spent time with him in his, at his father's village and at his aunt's village, and they slaughtered a goat for me. And that was pretty disconcerting. Maybe you've heard about Maasai, but, you know, their entire culture is based on cattle and on and herding and raising, and they raise their animals, you know, completely from the ground up, and blood is very important because, well, they'll bleed cows so they can get the nutrients from the blood without killing the cow, but blood of cows or goats or whatever is very important. So when they slaughtered the goat, they suffocated it because they wanted to keep the blood. That was really kind of horrifying. So yeah, I mean, I had some experience with it. It's difficult, but I think I learned and I became much more important having seen that happen as humanely as possible, and that the meat that I eat is not, you know, comes from animals who had at least, you know, dying's no fun, ever, but at least lived until that point healthily and happily. So that really brought that home to me, which is why I've become, you know, pretty hardcore against the way most of our meat is produced in this country, unfortunately.
Maybe we can end on a lighter note before we go. You could tell us.
I want a fun question.
No, I have a question. Oh. What is sausage made from?
What is sausage made from? it depends on the sausage. The sausage at Fleischer's is just good old fashioned. I mean, it's clean, lovely pork and fat, and there's no noses and lips and assholes and no. But
it's disappointing.
I'm sorry. I know. I wish I could tell you did something different, but we make head cheese, and that has, you know.
What's in head cheese?
Head cheese is when you take a pig's head and you brine it and you boil it down and you get all the meat off of it, so it's got all the little parts, little cheeks and lips and all that stuff.
Right.
So I can bring you some.
Appreciate it. All right, Julie Powell. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.